history through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are some stories there that really ought to be told. They definitely should not go untold because we want to honor our veterans for their service and sacrifice. We want to preserve their stories so we never forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And along the way, we sure do learn a lot. We're educated, we're entertained, and so often we're inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. Today, I am in a beautiful place called Falls City, Oregon, with 99-year-old Leonard Lonergan. This isn't where you grew up, though. Grants Pass, is that right?
Pretty much, Grants Pass and Eugene.
And you had a brother, a couple years older than you?
Three.
So what do you remember about those early years? Because these are the years that the country was going through a lot of interesting things.
Well, my dad had a meat market, which he owned, and it was in Piggly Wiggly. And we had a home that was about two blocks away. So weekends, which were the busy weekends, the farmers, there weren't any open stores on Sundays. So all the farmers came in on Saturday night. So on Saturday, my brother Bill and I often worked. Bill would help Mom at the counter, Dad would do all the cutting, and I would make the change. So learning how to count money was easy to do. So I remember Dad used to give us some money, and we'd go out for dinner together, my brother and I. It was always nice to go up to a restaurant and get our own dinner for the evening. Dad was a real strong guy, so he always kept us busy, trying to get him keep in shape, learning how to wrestle and stuff like that. Growing up as a youngster was nothing but fun. I followed my brother most of the time. 3 years old, he must have known everything. So life was pretty good.
And I know you're a big, big Oregon Ducks fan, but what about yourself? Did you have any athletic aspirations when you were going to school?
I was on the tennis team at Grants Pass. At Stanford, I played intramural. In fact, I was the fraternity coach for all sports when I was there. I won the intramural wrestling championship my freshman year, and the tennis championship, I think, my senior year.
When you were growing up, did you have some idea in your mind of, hey, someday this is what I'm going to do, this is the life I'm going to have?
Well, my thoughts were always to go into coaching.
Mm-hmm.
And then when the war came along, that's when that changed.
What about this whole idea of aviation? Because I'm looking at the fact that both you and your older brother served in the Army Air Corps during World War II. Is that something you were turned on to before the war, where you became aware of the possibility of getting up in the air?
No. That was for birds.
That was for birds. And you graduated high school in 1939.
Correct.
And you headed to Eugene from there?
Well, of course, we're in the Depression.
Mm-hmm.
And we don't have much money. Fortunately, I had a job in Safeway in the meat market. I worked 6 days a week for $18 a week. That was before unions came into that section. By the time of the 15 months, I had bought some clothing for school and all, had little over $500 left, and that was what my folks had. I was able to get into college. College was not near as expensive in those days.
No. Campus looked a little different, too.
It looked quite different, yeah.
Well, so you already had a little college under your belt before December 7th, 1941. Seems like everybody remembers something about that day. How about you?
Well, December the 7th was on a Sunday, and Sunday of the fraternity was, we have big band music, and that was the thing. We'd all gather around and listen to the great big bands, Glenn Miller and Sammy Kay and all the wonderful bands. And then, of course, the interruption when President Roosevelt came in about the war. Everything was pretty silent for a while. We knew things were going to change. We didn't know until a few months later exactly how.
And at this point, your brother's already been in the service for a year.
Yeah, he had joined in September of 40 because he knew he was smarter than I was. He knew that was going to be involved in the war, and so he was going to be ready. I've always had a hunch. He'd gone 3 years to college, and with money being as tight as it was, I always wondered if maybe part of his reason for going in the service was that he knew it'd be tough for the folks to have both of us in college at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
So I never asked him about that, But I always wondered.
But I'm sure there's some concern on your part, knowing that he's going to be in this war right away, and he was going to be flying. Were you aware of what he was up to or where he was?
He got commissioned in April of 42. Being in the Air Corps, there were no bases overseas, and since he was going to the Pacific, there was no way of getting there yet until they could get enough Navy people and people that could build bases and airfields and all to get him over. Mm-hmm. So it was probably September of 43 before he went over.
A few of the only places they had been attacked on December 7th, whether it was on Oahu in the Philippines, Clark Field was overrun. So what motivated you? Why did you decide to go into the Army Air Corps?
Well, once the war started, there was no question. You're going to be in the war. I mean, this is something that had to be done. So we were fortunate that we had a chance to choose the direction we were going.
Did you want to be a pilot as well?
The story was that when you went to school on it, you had to relate pilot as the place you wanted to go. They give you three choices. And the early talk was you had to put down pilot, 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 or they would think you're not, you weren't good enough. I put down pilot, pilot, and navigator on mine. I was not crazy to be a pilot particularly, but I was wanting to go that direction.
And when did you go into the service?
March of 43.
Mm-hmm. Did this strike you at the time as an interruption to your plans or to the life you were living?
No, we had a big thing that had to be done. There was no need to worry about anything else, because if that's not done, there's not going to be anything to worry about.
You mentioned your involvement in the fraternity. How many of your fraternity brothers were signing up just like you?
Pretty much. Surprisingly, a good share of them went to the Navy. A lot of the Navy people never got out of school. They got transferred two or three times, but never ever got out of college, which was kind of strange.
So for you, you joined the Army Air Corps, you put down pilot, pilot, navigator. What did they do with you?
Well, after going the different places we had to go before we got to the San Antonio area, there was a big base there that we took tests on, all kinds of tests. One of the things that they liked us to do was to keep athletically active, which was one of the reasons I got as far as I did, because they appreciated the fact that I was athletically active. So finally, after we have been through a number of months of different tests and different activities, this is it's time for selection. And I can remember the day, there was a hallway just filled with cadets like myself, and inside a room, a bunch of officers, and they would invite a gentleman in, and he'd either come out very happy or come out with tears and not so happy. This went on for a long, long time, and finally I realized I was the last guy. So they called me in, and they said automatically, this got about 8 or 10 guys from Ranch of Major on up, and they says, Mr. Lonigan, automatically we kick the last one out. And I kind of shrugged and grinned. And he says, no, you've done very well, and we see that you've put down both pilot and navigator. He says, our thought is that you would probably be a better job as a navigator. And I said, I'd be very happy with that.
So then you have some further schooling to master that art?
Well, yeah, now you have to wait until your school opens up at your navigation school. And this is not a long time, but maybe 2 weeks or a month and all. So you're really just kind of walking around the base and playing whatever ball you can. And we decide we're going to go to Ellington Field by Houston. So it's not really a big trip from San Antonio to Houston. So naturally you're going to start at night, because you never want to get in the base when you can see anything. Always got to be nighttime. At the incident that happened, I got on the train, sat down on the bench all alone, and then across from me was another cadet. We're gone for a little ways, and this very polite cadet says, y'all can put your feet up here if you want. And what he didn't know is my feet wouldn't reach. So I says, no, that's all right with me, but you're welcome to do that. And he did not. And when we stood up, we were just about eye to eye. And from that moment on, Paul Koshowabe and I became great friends. He later stayed on with the service and became, I think, at the end, lieutenant colonel. And Paul died 2 or 3 years ago, I think. Yeah.
Were there any challenges in that navigator school that you had to overcome?
Well, yeah, you had to work at it. I mean, it wasn't a gift. You had to learn to be able to do the things that needed to be done to tell the direction you're going, hopefully the speed. So, yeah, there were challenges.
Well, and it's so different from what we know today.
Yeah.
I was just flying up here in a jet that there's, you know, a GPS monitor right here that tells you everything you could possibly want to know.
Yeah, navigators just not needed anymore. But they were just kind of an or else on the 24s, on the bomber crews, because everything went off the lead bombing plane. Our co-pilot watched to see when the lead bombardier would drop a bomb. The lead navigator took him where we was going to go. And the only reason they needed this navigator is if you got shot out of formation, then you had to be able to bring him home.
Yeah, that's a heady responsibility. Yeah. Well, and I'm sure while you're training, you don't know if you're going to be in B-24s or B-17s.
We don't until the day we get to the, to the race, yeah.
Would there have been any difference for a navigator between those two planes? I mean, I know there's a difference for pilots.
I don't think so, just other than the location you are in the plane.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. When did you head overseas?
We were at Peterson Field near Colorado Springs. This is in June of 44.
Mm-hmm.
And we came back from a practice flight on the bus. And when we're coming into town, all of the church bells are ringing. And that was a sign that it was D-Day.
Wow.
So that's the 6th of June. On the 24th of June, my birthday, I had on the Queen Elizabeth going across. So it didn't take much time from the time of D-Day until they got us over there.
And did you guys already have your crew when you headed over?
Yes, that's what we formed our crew in Peterson Field.
So you're getting to know these guys that you're going to spend some real intense moments with.
You are.
And were they from all over?
Yeah, we had a radio man was from Yakima. Of course, time changed because most of us went back to school at the end of the war, and we went from there. So it's a little bit hard to locate where they were at the time.
Sure.
During the war years, the officers and the enlisted men didn't associate with each other, as you might know. The bombardier and the co-pilot and I didn't get along very well with the pilot, so we were always kind of a three-man team everywhere we went, and we never went any place with the pilot ever. Good pilot, terrible judgment.
That can create some issues.
Yes.
Well, I know this was a long time ago. I mean, if we go back to June of 1944, that's more than 76 years ago. But do you have any memories of the kinds of things that were going through your mind as you headed overseas? Because there's no guarantee you're ever coming back.
Well, I can remember I wanted to go home.
I don't blame you.
No, well, you know, you think, okay, what are you going to do when you get back? First thing, of course, is back to college and complete education. So really definite thoughts of what you're going to do are, with me, I know, weren't very positive.
And by this time, had you gotten any reports of your brother's activities flying P-39s in the Pacific?
No, I didn't get much news from him.
And these are two very different wars, especially in the air. But
completely different.
I just wonder if you had gotten any feedback about some of the dangers he had faced and if that affected your mindset at all.
No, we had enough. But our situation changed in the early part. I think the crews, the flights, were 25 missions was all they needed to do.
Right.
And that was almost too much in the early years. Until we got in, the thing that saved the Air Force and saved, I felt, really won the war was when they brought the P-51 and the P-47 over to England. Now we had fighters that could outdo their fighters. Now you could take a bombing crews in with these people and not lose all your bombers to the fighters.
Mm-hmm.
You're going to lose some to flak, but the fighters are the real danger.
Mm-hmm.
And that took care of that danger, which was a big help.
Was there anything memorable about that journey across the Atlantic?
Well, with Glenn Miller's band on board, it was kind of nice, except when you went to eat. A lot of people were not familiar with going on the ocean, and walking up to meals was not always appetizing.
I think I can read between the lines there.
Yeah.
And did you say you had Glenn Miller's band aboard the Queen Elizabeth?
Yes, he had flown over, but the band was there.
Uh-huh.
Johnny Desmond was their singer. Tex Beneke was with them. A good bunch, beautiful music, yeah.
And the whole ship with all those thousands of people had a big birthday party for you, right? When they sent you off?
Well, I'm not too sure they even knew it was my birthday.
Did you guys have to zigzag or no?
I think we had a little maneuvering. Not a whole lot, but I think there was some, yeah. Of course, the Liz was a pretty fast vessel at that time.
And what about once you got across the pond? What was waiting for you there?
Glasgow. That's where we came in. From Glasgow, we went to a little place that must have been just a holding place, because we didn't do anything except wait. So you're such a bunch of people coming from different places. You only have so many that they can take care of at a time. So we went to this little town called Stone, England, and the three of us went into town, and there was a little kind of a carnival that seemed to be a proper thing. So there were always little kids there, so we could bring gum and candy to the little kids. And didn't really do anything. Then they sent us over to Northern Ireland, and this was quite interesting, and this was just our crew. With all the thousands of people that were on that ship, I was amazed that there were so few of us that went there. So then we had different movies on what to do, how to bail out German aircraft. We'd been studying aircraft on the way up and flags on the way up. Now it was all German and Belgium and different flags like that to study. We weren't there very long, but maybe a month. Learned a lot about the Irish. They would often make hard-boiled eggs for us, or we could buy fresh eggs and take them in and cook them. They always kept their doors open, and the sheep and the pigs and whatever else went in like any other Irishman. It was a very, very congenial group.
So you've learned a lot. They've told you what to watch for. They've prepared you every way they can, but you haven't flown a mission yet. Were you a little anxious before that first mission?
Yeah, you can imagine. Our first mission is to Ludwigshafen. Now, what they have not done is done a good job of training us, because most of us guys have not flown at altitude. Mm-hmm. We've strictly flown at 10,000 feet and all. Don't need oxygen at all. Here we're going to Ludwigshafen, and we're not real oxygen safe. I'm having a problem. I'm upset, and I'm throwing up. And poor old Tom is in there, and the nose is the bombardier. He's trying to keep putting a mask back on my face for me until I sober up. The one waist gunner passes out, and the other waist gunner revives him. So we came back a pretty ragged crew, and the first two planes above us, in front of us, went down.
On your very first mission?
On the very first mission, and most of the crew was really shook by that. I was not, because I was throwing up.
You had bigger problems for you, huh?
Yeah, so I missed out on that. After that, we became a pretty good crew, but it took some learning. I'm surprised that more first crew people weren't lost.
It's time for our first break, but there's much more to come with 99-year-old Leonard Lonergan of Falls City, Oregon, his closest calls with the 453rd Bomb Group during World War II, and his view of the most famous member of that bomb group, a Hollywood star I'm sure you remember. Hometown Heroes will be right back after this.